What we did on Tuesday was something that is, I think, very easy and very simple to describe, but not so easy to think through and apply for ourselves. That is, assuming that the hypotheses which I suggested on Tuesday have any validity. Those hypotheses are very simple. And that, the first one is that all of the language that we use about God has to be analogical language. Now, analogies are ways of speaking that say this is in some way like that, or this is in some way not like that. So I may not have any direct experience of this, but I make certain assertions about this on the basis of that which I have direct experience of. I want to just, since we're doing this rather quickly, I want to be sure that I'm being clear enough, so if you have a question at this point, this would be an important time to ask it.
Is this why the intellectual know-how doesn't always click with the gut feeling that you've got on something?
That is right. That is right. Because intellectually, I may think something about God, but feel something quite different. And that immediately brings us to our second point, but I don't want to cut off questions on the the two important points are that we do not have direct experience of God. Let me give you an example of that. In some ways, I have direct experience of you. I can see that you have bodies which are in human form. Everyone in this room has two eyes, one nose, two ears. Right? That's not to be taken for granted. If I could see the hands of all of you, I could determine how many of us had 10 fingers. And if we weren't wearing shoes, I could tell how many of us had 10 toes. Now, that is direct kind of knowledge. But there's a lot of other things going on in this room. Inside each one of you is experiencing within yourself. And I can only know about your own internal experience if you are willing to share that with me. Now, when you share your internal experience with me, that is meaningful to me because I myself have similar experience. When my relatives in North Carolina come up to me and say, "My bones feel sweet today," I do not know what they are talking about. My bones have never felt sweet. Now, I know that they feel that their bones feel sweet, but I don't. Now, apparently, in the process of growing up, they had the kinds of experiences that gave this feeling of bones feeling sweet some meaning for them. I have no way of knowing whether it means anything for them or not. It is so much their own interior personal experience that it's inaccessible to me. However, if one of them comes up and says, "I am angry at you because you borrowed $20 from me and haven't paid it back," I don't have too much trouble understanding that inner experience. Even though they may come up and say it in the very friendly southern manner. I was wondering if you might be able to return the $20 which you borrowed from me 7 years ago. So I can understand that. Now, what are the analogies that are most useful in our thinking about God? My hypothesis, which I am trying to test with you, is that the most useful analogies for thinking about God and for giving some meaning to our internal experience of God are those experiences which come from interpersonal relationships. The ones I'd like to work with you on here are primarily family, because that's very common New Testament terminology. What I'm saying is that each one of us brings to our relationship to God a particular pattern of direct experiences with the persons who were part of our family and who are part of our family. These experiences are very useful analogies for helping us think about our experience of God. So, last time we talked about trust. And we talked about what it means that all of us learned to trust while we were little children in relationship to our parents. We learned to trust long before we could think. That's the first thing a little baby has to learn, is to trust. Our little baby learns to trust by being loved. And if you really love a baby, that baby will learn to trust. It's also possible to treat a baby in such a way that the baby does not learn to trust. And it's also possible to be so inconsistent in the way in which you respond to a baby that the baby can't straighten out what trust is or what mistrust is, what love is or not being loved is. The world just doesn't make any sense. I don't say this as an experiment for you to try, you know. But if you want to have trouble with a child, then go in to wake it up on Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays with a smile. And on Tuesdays, Wednesdays, and Thursdays, being very angry and with a spanking. And on Sundays, go in deadpan. Completely, the child will have no consistent pattern of experience to which to relate anything and will not develop trust. Now, when we say, in my thinking about God, and in my understanding of my relationship to God, I am working with experiences which are internal to me, which are the way in which I, as a little child, learned to trust or not trust the people with whom I lived. We are opening up the internal experience of each one of us. And what we suggested is that when we say, I trust God or do not trust God, we are using analogies that come out, basically, out of our relationships to our parents. When we began to think about that, some people in the group, I don't know if any of them are here this morning because I did not try to particularly identify any individual with what was being said. But some people in the group began to take the external sentence which we communicate to one another, I trust God, and with that sentence in hand, to go in and to unlock their internal experience, and to say, what does trust mean for me? In that process, some people said, for me to trust in God, I say that God is like my Father. Other persons said, for me to trust in God means that God is in many ways not like my Father. Now, at that point, we have what seem to be two contradictory assertions. And if we would raise those to the level of theological statements, we would have a controversy. My hypothesis then is that in our conversations about our religious experience and in our theological conversations, in order to understand one another, we need to share with one another whatever of the internal experience that gives meaning to our theological and religious verbalizations. We need to share whatever of that is meaningful to us and that we're willing to share. Because when I go in, and I need to say this to you this morning, when I go into my internal experience, that can be frightening. And you don't need to do that this morning. You can try it if you want to. But if you get nervous or feel that things are going to be a little difficult for you and you want to back off from that, that's fine. I am going to, if you want to, however, go in and talk about some of that experience, I'll be glad to do that with you too. Okay? But don't share anything you're not comfortable in sharing. Now that is why theological controversy gets so bitter, in my opinion. It's because when we talk theology, we're always talking analogy out of very, very basic interpersonal experiences. On Tuesday, I referred to them as primal experiences. Experiences that shape and form our experience in that dimension for the rest of our lives. That means whenever anyone talks religion or theology to me, in order for me to understand what that person is talking about, I am, whether I know it or not, involved in hearing something about that person's internal private experience. And in order to understand that, I have to listen to my internal private experience, and sometimes that makes me mad. So that seems to me to be one reason why theologians get so angry with one another. Because please don't make me think about things that I'm really not able to handle. Now, let me give you an example. I teach entering seminarians. And one of the things which our seminary asks them to do is to write an autobiographical essay, which, however we phrase it, is, how did I come to be the kind of person that I am? And that means, we say to them, we want you to go back and find out as much as you can about yourself, about what it was like when you were born, when you were an infant. Was your mother like, your father like? How were you treated? How did you feel? Go into this internal experience. Well, it almost always happens that some people whom we ask to do that become very, very angry. Because they say, nobody is going to make me say that my father was not perfect. That's a statement that I hear from time to time. I just had the best father in the world. And it's part of my religious piety to say that my father was perfect. And if you're asking me to say anything that might make it look to you as though my father were not perfect, you are doing something highly irreligious. And I will not even write about my father, because somebody just picking that up and reading it might draw the conclusion that my father was not perfect. For that person, that kind of student, has dealt with the internal experience by saying, my father is like God, and God is like my father. And any assertion then about God which describes God as being different from that person's father will create anxiety. And any encounter with anyone who trusts in God as though God were different than his father will also make him nervous. Because the need is to assert that my father is like God. The theological form of the statement is to say God is like my father. So what we did on Tuesday was then to explore together some of the ways in which some of us felt God is like our father and God is not like our father. Now, I'm not going to go back and redo that unless some of you have some things you're feeling I need to talk about this. But I'd like on that basis then to talk with you about two New Testament passages. One is where Paul says that all fatherhood in heaven and earth is named after God. I was on dish team this morning. I didn't get back in time to look up the passage. So where is it?
I think before you step on into that space, we also agreed at that session, I think, and it kind of clarifies things a little bit in terms of the relationship of you and your father, that all mankind is imperfect, whereas we think of the divine being as perfect.
Right.
So in no way could a perfect be an imperfect or an imperfect be a perfect.
That's so, your internal experience. But there are people who say, I had the good fortune to have a perfect.
I thought we agreed on that the other day.
No, some people said that.
But
I suspect that in a group this size, there were some people who disagreed with that. Didn't say anything, but who said, that does not match my internal experience. My father was just perfect. Now, I happen to agree with you intellectually that all of us are imperfect and there now are no imperfect parents. But if you ask me, how is God not like your father? You're asking me a question that I'm really going to have to work to answer. Because anything that I think in response to that question is going to arouse some anxiety in me. For some people last time, for example, talked about the fact that fathers, that one of the things we experience from fathers is that they don't always keep their promises. Don't always keep their promises. I remember when my father didn't keep a promise to me. And I still feel about that. You know? He promised me something if I would do something that he didn't expect me to do, and I did it. And he couldn't even afford to keep the promise, I'm sure. I still feel about that. And can any of you remember what it felt like to find out that there is no Santa Claus? Or that there's only been one virgin birth? Oh my, you see. So, if you ask me to say, how is God like my father, that's well, kind of comfortable. But if you ask me to say, how is God not like my father, that's kind of disturbing. Now, I think that's what Paul's talking about when he says that all fatherhood in heaven and earth is named after God. That the standard of God's being father, it is not, he is not saying that the standard of God's being father is whatever we happen to encounter in our earthly fathers. But that earthly fathers are fathers insofar as they are like what God is. Extremely, would be extremely fascinating to stop and develop a doctrine of God on that basis. But then, you know, Jesus says, call no man father. He doesn't say, call one man father. And I doubt very much that he was thinking about any father whom you have is in some way not entirely like God. If you understand that, then you can also understand why. It may be that hating father and mother is not just a particular test which comes to a few of us, but which is the inevitable accompaniment of growing in trust in God. That the more we come to trust in God and experience His love to us, the closer we come to encountering the imperfection of our parents. And if I stop and say at that point, well, if God is different than my parents, give me my parents every time, I am not going to be able to move forward in trust in God. So I appreciate your introducing that into the conversation, because I too, as that was being said, thought, well, that's good. We agree on that. We don't have to stop and talk about it. So I didn't.
Well, you stop and think about the limitations, the filthy, physical limitations of the mind and the brain and the nervous system, and then you realize that you think beyond that is God, and this is the creation of God.
Right.
How could any part of that equal God?
Okay. But in some ways, good fathers are like God. And it is, we cannot call God our Father in heaven without comparing and contrasting Him, finding some similarities and some differences to our Father on earth. Now, some people actually, some people have, in my experience, trustworthy some days, not trustworthy other days. And their experience was that they could not trust in God. And they were not able, in my pastoral experience, to move beyond that until we went back and talked about their parents and went through that difficult and painful process of saying, well, there are no perfect parents. As I say, if you can remember when you found out that there is no Santa Claus, that your parents didn't always tell the truth, there is no virgin birth, that your mother perhaps was not the best cook in the world or the most beautiful woman, that your father was not the smartest man or not the strongest man, if you can observe that in yourself or observe the pain of it in some other child with whom you have an association, you can understand the pain of trusting in God. I think that is a good bit of the pain and sorrow of repentance, of coming to a new way of thinking about God, a new way of responding and relating to God.
Another thing that makes it difficult to do that is the same thing as why am I afraid to tell you who I am? Because if I do, you're not going to like me as well. And you, this is about yourself. But when you step even beyond yourself and then say, my Father isn't perfect, and people, again, do not like you as well because they don't all have that same experience, and you really expose yourself, and it's very tender.
Yeah, not because they, I would say, between the two of us, not because they all don't have that experience, but because they don't like you for reminding them that they've had it too. They've put their lives together and organized their internal experience around the assumption that there is perfection. If not in you, then in your parents. And that true piety begins with asserting, my parents are perfect. I may not be, you know, but my parents are. So I have to take full responsibility for what I am. Yeah? And I, you push people on this as I push seminarians. You get some pretty strong, angry responses. And I get some against myself when I do it too. I mean, I'm not talking about a difficulty that only some of us experience. I feel that this is a difficulty which all of us experience, and it's an experience that some of us are more painfully conscious of than others. Okay? But that there are only differences in degree in the imperfection of parents. Very slight, relatively slight variations in degree. Yeah, I recognize that we have a little 16-month-old daughter, and trying to decide how to respond to her. If you've had the fortune, good or bad, to have us sit at the table with you, to wonder when she takes the food and throws it down, to wonder how to respond to that. Should I slap her? Should I give it back to her? I'm very much at a loss as a father as to know what is the right thing to do at that time. But whatever I do, she has to live with. And she has to make sense out of that world. So I become part of her reality. Okay? And that's what I'd like to focus on today, is the whole question of freedom and reality. People who small children learn to trust, begin to will to do certain things. I was angry with her one day, and a friend of mine who's a pastor on Long Island was visiting us, and he said, I have friends who have such a wonderful baby. It never does that kind of thing. It doesn't cry and wave its fists and kick. It never resists you when you want to do something. Whatever you do, that's all right. If breakfast comes at 7, that's good. If it comes at 10, that's all right too. Of course, as he went on, she began to suspect. That's not so wonderful. That's a baby that has serious difficulties. Because it's part of our experience of human development that as we learn to trust, we begin to develop autonomy. We begin to develop a will. We begin to feel that this is what I want to do, and I can do what I want to do, and that feels pretty good. And when my parents won't let me do that, I feel pretty frustrated and angry with them. Now, theologically, this is the question of the freedom of the will, the bondage of the will. And what the doctrine, Lutheran doctrine of the bondage of the will says is that if you do not trust in God, you cannot will to trust in Him. That's the bondage of the will. Nothing more than that. God has to create trust in us before we can will to trust in God. So we don't trust in God because, Lutherans say, because out of my experience of not trusting in God, I have decided that I want to trust in God. But rather, that out of my experience of trusting God, I also experience willing to trust in God.
Are you saying experiencing God's trustworthiness?
Yes.
But that they can trust Him?
Right. And that is why faith is always a gift, why we cannot cooperate in bringing ourselves to faith, why the experience of God's love has to come to us from the outside. That seems to me to be the theological dimension of this doctrine. But when God has brought us to faith, when we have in some way experienced His love, and He creates trust in us, then we also begin to will in relationship to God. Just as, and it seems to me the parallel is that when I as a child begin to learn to trust in my parents, and that trust is adequately developed, it's never perfect in any of us, it's part of not having perfect parents, I also begin to will in relationship to the world around me. And the more trust, the more will. In relationship to God, I also begin to will. Now, I think that understanding something about my experience as a parent in relationship to a child who is developing willpower and autonomy helps me understand something about God's relationship to me as a child of God who is developing into the spiritual freedom, into the freedom of the children of God. and understanding something about the complex decisions that I as a parent need to make in setting limits to the freedom of my child. And the constantly shifting nature of the limits that I set helps me understand something about the kinds of complex tasks that God is involved in bringing his children into greater maturity. I can understand that intellectually. But I also have an inner experience of what it was like to develop autonomy and to have limits set for me, and the ways in which I felt about that. And knowing the variety of ways of being a parent, I suspect that every one of us in this room, even if we grew up in a Swedish community in Western Minnesota, probably have had quite different inner experiences. My hypothesis is that those inner experiences are the stuff out of which our response to God, in terms of exercising our own freedom as his children, accepting the limitations of reality, and imagining for ourselves that there are limitations that do not exist, that personal experience which each of us brings is the experience out of which we respond and the experience out of which we give meaning to our experience of God and try to communicate it to one another.
When you get this experience yourself as a child, and you have a brick wall kind of autonomy as far as your parent is concerned, it would be a lesson, I think, in passing that experience along to your children verbally, so they don't have a "this is what you have to do" without some explanation. I mean, possibly explaining the consequence to them. I know of some people who feel, you say, or sort of "I told you so" sort of thing. Don't ride your bicycle down that steep hill, period. But you could also add, because a car might be coming, you might hit a stone, you might run into gravel at the bottom of the road, you could break your leg, and explain a little bit. I don't think it hurts to do a little bit more of that kind of thing. Usually we're too much of a hurry, and right now they're frustrating us and say, "Go away now, do what I say, I'm busy." And the poor child is left there with that old command, "This is it. Father says so, or mother says so."
Do what I say without relationship to reality. In other words, there are parent-child relationships in which there is no relationship to reality. Now, let me sharpen what you were saying just a little bit by talking about the child to whom you cannot explain. Our 16-month-old likes to climb stairs. It's a great thing. She also likes to come downstairs. She likes to walk. And she doesn't know when she's walking over the edge. Now, how do I see, the difficult task that I have as a parent then is setting limits for her and saying it's all right to go there and to run there, but when you start running there, I'm going to stop you. How do I do that in such a way that I do not break the child's will or the child's freedom? Because I really don't want to do that either. Now, one way I can do it is by loving, by having a loving attitude. But you know, when you have gotten up for the fourth time from a conversation, which you always leave right at the most important point, to go back and retrieve a child. It's not all love. So, you know, my daughter will carry in her experience of me setting limits some love. I hope a lot of it. But she'll also, no matter how hard I work at it, she will also carry with her some feeling that the setting of limits is an angry thing. Teenagers report on that experience to us very openly. You're just making me come in at 11 o'clock because you want to ruin my life. Can never have any fun. You've always done that. I say, always done that. You've always done that. You were always at it. You're just doing that. I try to lay out the reality. You do not know what the reality is. You don't know what I do. I can handle myself. Yes.
See, I don't see the setting of limits. I don't connect that with anger. I connect that with love.
Mm-hmm.
And the child, I think, that's most frustrated is the one that doesn't have any limits. We have a boy living with us now whose mother's an alcoholic. He's been completely on his own. And he wants limits desperately. He'll come up and ask me, can I go out and play basketball? None of my kids, it wouldn't occur to them to ask me that. This kid is searching for some limits.
Mm-hmm.
He wants somebody, some structure in his life.
Okay.
And love is part of his structure. The most frustrated people don't have any. Nobody cares enough for them to set any limits or even be concerned about them.
That's right.
So I don't see it as an angry thing. I think you're transmitting love more than you are anger when you set those limits.
Mm-hmm.
Child sees it as anger. They're the ones who interpret it as anger, not as a parent. I'm angry at my child, and thus I set a limit. I set a limit because I love my child, but the child says, I don't like that. I'm mad. I don't like that limit. I want to be free.
Yeah, but the parent is angry at that moment. Like you said, the fourth time you've gotten up, you are a little bit angry, and they realize, they feel that anger.
I want to affirm also, though, what you were saying about not setting limits. You see, it is not a loving thing to let a 16-month-old child start down a flight of stairs. That is not a loving thing. And if I do not take very careful precautions to prevent that from happening, you have to understand that I am probably at that point feeling considerable irritation with the child.
Perhaps at that age, another approach of removing the situation when possible, removing the danger, like the
plug-in covers and the gates across the stairs, or setting a chair across the stairs or something like that, so that the parent is not constantly frustrated, therefore can relate to the conversation he or she is in, or to the child in a more loving way rather than an angry, frustrated way.
Right.
So that the child doesn't have the danger and doesn't have the anger or frustration, and yet has limits set and has a boundary, but within which, how can I say it, a boundary that allows enough freedom for the age of the child and the maturity of the child, but not so much freedom that there's danger involved, then there's not quite so much interaction between the parent and child on a limit setting or disciplinary basis. It could be more a loving, relating basis.
Mm-hmm. That,
but you can't follow that to the nth degree.
No.
Because somewhere there has to be a limit that is a matter of will. Because otherwise you will become the protective soul who is always seeing that there's no possible danger there. And this, in consequence, you are hurting the child because you are not building in that child the sense of the no that has to be in life.
You can do that for it as much as possible for a time.
As summer is long, now you got to open up the door.
Right. Otherwise, you go along on the honeymoon, assuming that it ever comes to that point.
But according then to the age of the child and what they're able to understand,
right.
So that there aren't limits that the child cannot relate to.
As for instance,
but
if you have to take every object and hide it, when a youngster comes of a certain age and he still grows larger, there are no words that told him, now listen, leave things alone. And you're hurting the child. If somewhere there isn't this, it's no.
Right. But it's one way of doing it, and I'm just throwing out ideas so we can get the full range of it. One way of doing it is to give to the child a lot of objects that it's all right for the child to do anything with, like pots, pans, that you're willing to risk and that are kind of noisy and that are considered to be that child's area of freedom.
But in the utopian situation which you have built for that child, you are not opening up what the famous educator John Dewey, his whole philosophy was based on knowledge through experiencing. Knowledge through experiencing. So if you experience a fall, you find that stairway, going down that stairway, you're able to fall down if you don't go down a certain way. So you start sliding down on your rump. See?
Mm-hmm.
And so the degrees of experiencing come in. So the relationship between that and protectiveness, I think, they enter into the childhood.
Okay, so we need to, if we are going to help the child understand that there are some things which it's all right for the child to want to do, but which should not be done because of the danger in doing them, we need to introduce at some point into the child's experience the experience of doing things that fail or doing things that have negative results.
I think we shouldn't forget though that the parent isn't the only one who's making limits. The child's friends are going to put limits on him to give. There's one ball and both of them want it.
Mm-hmm.
There's going to be who's going to have it, or the tribe, the right, and so on, to the little, other people come in there that are setting limits on them as well. And that's something we begin to learn quite early, that you have to stick in those certain limits for whatever group we're with.
which is one of the reasons why two-year-olds are not very good caretakers for one another. Because they're, you know, if there's one bull, one of them is going to assert a great deal of will and possibly even violence. Yeah.
Question occurred, has occurred to me. When children reach, say, age of puberty and so forth, they're starting to exert this will, trying to make the break. They're testing the limits. They want them, but they're testing them. They're making a break. Okay, this is the time in the Lutheran Church when we're putting them through confirmation, the religious period of religious instruction. Psychologically, is this a good time? Or are they probably conditioned at that point to, if they're fighting their parents, are they looking for something else? So does that make a good time? Or are they ready to fight? Here's another set of limits now that's being explained or, you know, clarified for me to them. And are they less receptive at that time? I wondered about this. The mental step of a child at that point in time regarding religious instruction, the first real serious, you know. Is there any connection there, or has anybody ever thought about that?
Yeah, obviously, because there are a lot of Lutheran churches now that confirm in the fifth and sixth grade. Confirm at 9, 10, 11, rather than 12, 13, and 14. Another solution would be to do it toward the end of adolescence when there's a quite a different opportunity to think about that. But of course, think about our relationship to God. But of course, the first thing that comes to mind then is that a lot of people who will get confirmed when they are 10, 11, 12, or 13, 14, 15, that there's a lot of them, 18, 19, 20, are going to say, no, I don't want anything to do with that. So one of the advantages of early confirmation is that we, it seems to me, address ourselves to children before this they experience this kind of rebelliousness. The disadvantage, it seems to me, is that they then live their lives feeling that it was laid upon them. Yeah?
Yes, you say, that, I think you indicate that the faith is not bootstrappable, and I have some difficulty with that.
Okay.
But I think it's probably certainly theologically sound, for sure. That when you get into, when you come to faith later in life, is this the corollary, this relationship of parent to the faith and how it's conditioned and acted out? So is this as critical, or once you're independent of parents, does that, you still go back to those?
Okay,
you see what I'm getting at?
Yeah, I think I do. Since we're at the bell, let me try and respond very, very directly.
Yeah.
First of all, I want to say it may be your experience that faith is bootstrappable. Because it just may be that you have in your internal experience, out of which you understand your relationship to God, something like this. That there was a time when you found it very difficult to trust a parent or someone else in authority because you knew very realistically about certain imperfections and weaknesses and failures of that person. Right? But that you then made the decision. Right? You had enough trust to make the decision to say, I will trust this parent or person in authority in those areas in which I know this parent or person in authority is trustworthy. And in those areas in which I know this parent or person in authority is not trustworthy, I will not trust. Okay? So then, in your experience, faith may be bootstrappable, and it may be that it is extremely meaningful for you to emphasize the role of your will in your trust in God, because that's the way you structure your own internal experience. Now, that was there was a second point which you made after that.
Yeah, I'm wondering about the necessary correlation and relationship of this conditioning process of parents and how you feel about them in relationship to a faith that comes long after you're independent of parents. That the parents are really a thing. I'm sure that a very critical part of you is still there, but it's still way back. They're dead, they're gone, and then the faith comes.
Okay. My feeling is that most of us who are going to work through our relationship to God need to go back and work through those experiences. We need to be open and willing, open to our own internal experience and willing to look at it. And that a lot of the difficulties which people have in spiritual life can be understood in terms of the fact that that internal experience is too painful or too difficult or too far hidden, too unavailable, too unremembered to get back to. That's a good point to stop, because essentially that's what we're going to be talking about next time. And we're going to look at the problem of guilt. Saturday morning, want to look at various concepts of sin, but then want to zero in on some of our experiences of guilt and what their relationship is to our internal experience of ourselves.